Welcome today to our interview series with outstanding professionals. I am Stephen Ibaraki, and I'm conducting an exclusive interview with the legendary Guy Kawasaki, Chairman and Managing Director of Garage Technology Ventures, an early-stage venture capital fund. Guy, your books, blog, and past history as evangelist, entrepreneur, investment matchmaker, investment banker, and venture capitalist has placed you into, I would say, legendary status. What do you consider to be your most notable achievements?
Well, first of all, I'm not sure about the legendary status thing, other than perhaps being a legend in my own mind. I guess what people associate me most with is evangelizing Macintosh. I worked for the Macintosh division from 83 to 87, and I was very visible in my efforts to make sure that there was Macintosh software. And after that, I started several software companies. I've made a lot of speeches and written 8 books, and now I'm a venture capitalist. So I don't know about the legendary stuff. You know, when you start taking yourself that serious, it's the beginning of the end. Not even I take myself that seriously.
Well, you know, I actually hear that term all the time, and I recently did a keynote at a conference, and I indicated that I was going to be doing this interview, and a number of people commented and said, "You mean that legendary guy, Kawasaki?" And I said, "That's the man."
Well, if I'm legendary, what is Steve Jobs? I mean...
Another legendary figure.
I guess so.
Right. And, you know, I know that you read a lot. I mean, I've been following your blog. In fact, I would say you read voraciously, and you have a keen sense of what's coming up and future trends. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us your viewpoint of what you see as the leading new concepts or models for the world Internet industry that will really make an impact on us?
Well, in a rare moment of Guy Kawasaki humility, let me tell you that I don't consider myself a visionary. In fact, I don't consider VCs visionaries. What VCs and I do is hopefully we guess right having seen the future. But that's very different from inventing the future. I think that it's much more likely that two guys in a garage, two gals in a garage, or a guy and a gal in a garage, or in a PhD program, or in a lab, or a spare bedroom, or something like that, are the visionaries that's going to invent the future. I think my strength is my judgment about, you know, if I see various versions of the future, I might be able to pick the one that actually happens.
So do you have any sense of what you think will be something that may capture your interest in the future, or you prefer not to get into that area?
Well, you know, I'll make some guesses. I think that the world is going to evolve where everything has a chip in it, from light bulbs to toilets to TVs to everything, and everything will have an IP address, everything will be communicating. At an extreme, your toilet might send your physician an email saying, "You better check this guy for prostate cancer." That's one vision of the world. But, you know, I think that's the beauty of innovation, is that you can sit here and sort of predict and think and cogitate, but it's going to be something totally from left field that you never expected, and that's going to change the world, and I love that.
Well, that's an interesting perspective, and that's true, I guess, right?
Well, I hope so. I mean, it would be a sad thing if people, you know, I'm 51 years old, if 51-year-old people were the ones predicting the future. I prefer a world where it's 19, 20, 21, 22, 23, 24, 25-year-olds predicting the future.
You know, I read a Time article recently about actually, the human brain gets better at sort of amalgamating different pieces of information after you're post, let's say, 45. And so you're really hitting your stride.
Oh, I may be amalgamating, but I'm not inventing. That's for sure.
Okay, well, another question is, you know, you see so much information about China, and, like, you know, China's rising and it's booming economically. Mm-hmm. What do investors in Silicon Valley think about China's future and investing in China?
Well, I'd say there's basically two classes of investors when it comes to China in Silicon Valley. One says, oh, my God, there's billions of people there. It's a growing economy. They're on the part of the curve that's going to take off, and it's just the most exciting thing. We've got to get something into there. So that's one half, and that's the people who are, you know, betting on Chinese companies and all that. Another half, or I don't know if it's 50-50, but another group of people look at that and say, well, who knows what you're really buying in China? And who knows how, if you are successful, you can take the money out of China. And it's fraught with risk. It's sort of the Wild West days. And so they would love to tap into this, you know, multi-billion people market, but they're not quite sure how. And I happen to be more in that camp. You know, it's just as easy to lose money close as it is far. So it's sort of a conundrum for many people, and it's not clear that, you know, just because there's billions of people and it's a rising economy, therefore you should throw money at it. Because it is a tricky thing. You just never know what you're getting involved with there. You know, because of the legal system, I mean, it's a whole new world.
So do you see any ways to kind of bridge that, let's say taking on some close partners in that market space perhaps to reduce the risk, or some other means of getting more of an information and communication and relationships channel into China to reduce the risk?
Well, you know, I dislike the word partnership because, you know, most partnerships are formed without really knowing the other party very well. So, you know, let's say that you follow that line of reasoning. I know if I go to China myself, I'll get ripped off, so I'll find a partner. Well, how do you find a partner that you know won't rip you off? I don't know. That's the big question. And, you know, very few people who are going to rip you off come up to you and say, you know what, I'm going to rip you off. Everybody says, I'm trustworthy, I'm proven, I'm well capitalized, I'm connected, you know, my cousin is the premier's whatever. You know, everybody has a good story. Nobody tells you they're a crook. So how do you decide? I don't know. I don't know. It helps to come from China, I tell you that. I mean, if you look at it the opposite way, let's suppose that you are an investor, a rich individual in China, and you're saying, wow, the American economy, you know, it's still strong. It's going to take off. I've got to invest some money in America because I need to hedge my bet. I can't just, you know, only put all my eggs in my basket in the Far East. So I'm going to make some bets in America. And from knowing what I know about America, I would say that that person, you know, it's not that easy to just fly over here, land in San Francisco, and start placing bets. So if it's hard for that person to place bets in America, a country I know, it's got to be hard for me, an American, going to China and placing bets in a country I don't know. So, you know, it's not that easy.
Well, it almost sounds like then you're talking about, and I see this sort of in your blog sometimes, about building some kind of a relationship of trust, but it takes time.
Yes. I think it takes a long time. And now, don't get me wrong, you can just get lucky, too. I don't have any prejudice against luck, but I think when you depend on luck, that's a little tricky.
What do you think the investor views are on the Internet space in China, which really seems to be burgeoning and booming right now?
Well, it's just sort of the same question asked a slightly different way. I mean, you know, obviously, Draper Fisher Jurvetson pulled it off, right? I mean, they made a great investment in China. And you know, there's a lot of people buying computers and getting Internet access. I mean, don't get me wrong, the whole thing looks great. I just, the fact that something looks great doesn't necessarily mean that, you know, it's easy. That's my whole point. We're dealing with a very, very complex question here.
Well, you have your book going out there in China. Can you talk more about that?
Well, yeah, my book is being translated into both simple and complex Chinese, and I hope that this generation of Chinese entrepreneur will look at this book as, you know, sort of no pun intended, a little manifesto, and see, this is a capitalist manifesto, however, and get some insight into the process of entrepreneurship, at least as it has been defined in America. It may be completely different in China. But this is the way it has been done in America. And I think that they could probably get as much knowledge about entrepreneurship, you know, from reading one book as possible by reading this one. Of course, I'm a little prejudiced, obviously. So yeah, I look forward to that. And, you know, using the old entrepreneurial pitch, it's just 1% of the people in China buy that book. My God, you know how many I'll sell? So
that's the art of the start.
Yes, yes.
So what key points do you think will build value or will resonate with the audience in China out of that book, if you were to guesstimate?
I think that the process of building a company, of raising money, of pitching the company, of branding it and positioning it, all of those processes have to take place, whether a company is Chinese or American. So I think I provide a good foundation for any entrepreneur to get going.
I caught your presentation at the recent Angel Forum, and you summarized some key points for startups to be successful and to get the interest of VCs. Can you list some of those key points?
Yeah, well, you know, the first thing is most people, of course, they pitch with PowerPoint, and my first recommendation is your PowerPoint presentation should be about 10 or 15 slides long. You should be able to give it in 20 minutes. And the smallest font you should use is 30 points. So that's, you know, the 10-20-30 rule. So it's all about brevity and getting to the point. A second point is you have to have a real business model, not one of these imagined ones where you say you'll get millions of eyeballs and somehow you'll use Google AdSense or you'll advertise to them or somehow you'll monetize it. Trust me, you know, just give me the money, I'll get the eyeballs and we'll figure it out. The third piece of advice is I would tell entrepreneurs to never ask customers to do something that they themselves would not do. Sometimes when you have a cool product, you think this product is so cool that people won't mind jumping through hoops to use it. And, you know, you wouldn't do that, but you, because you're the entrepreneur, you expect people to do it for your product. And it never happens that way. So I think these are some of the key points about, you know, starting a company like that.
You also talk about something about innovation, right? And it should be something, it's like not a 10% change or...
Yes, it should be a 10 times change. To do things only 10% better, it's underwhelming. People should shoot for the next curve or to create the next curve and not just do things better, faster, cheaper, but just different. Do it different. Do it on the next curve. That's where the real meaning and the real money is made.
Well, it's interesting, and I noticed you had this sort of discussion about vision and mission statements and sort of what's the sort of the traditional model and how you sort of believe in this sort of quick phrase that really resonates, and you have that even in your own case, right, in terms of how you describe your company.
Well, we have described our company in a very funny way. We've done things as safe and mundane as capital for innovation, but we definitely toyed with the idea of calling, you know, our sort of tagline as being, we take the FU out of funding. But we didn't exactly use that, but it entered my mind to use it. My personal mantra is to empower entrepreneurs. That's what I do.
You know, one of the things I've been doing lately is I've been talking with successful serial entrepreneurs, and I sort of get this consistent message from them, and they say, hold off on VCs. Don't get VCs involved. Avoid VCs. What are your views on that?
I think that's a simplistic answer. There are times where a venture capital is perfect for a company. There are times when it's not. I don't think you should blanket say you should never go to VCs, nor would I say you should always go to VCs. You know, people need to understand that a VC is trying to create a company or fund a company that within 5 to 7 years is doing $200-400 million in business. And so there are many companies that are viable but not fundable. For example, to take an extreme, a clothing store, a restaurant, a web design services company, a PR firm, an advertising firm, unlikely to be good VC deals because they're just unlikely to do $200-300 million in 5 years. So those people shouldn't try for venture capital. It's not appropriate. On the other hand, there are people who are going to shoot for the moon like that, and they are appropriate. Now, you could say you should delay going to venture capital as long as possible. I mean, that's more true. that if you can get to a prototype or get to shipping or get to revenue or, you know, even get to profitability before you raise venture capital, yes, I would say that that is better. On the other hand, if you need venture capital to get to those points, you need venture capital. You should raise it. So it's not as simple as to say you should always avoid venture capital.
Well, I guess you'd have a great perspective on it because you've done it all, right? You've been an entrepreneur. You've been a matchmaker in terms of matching funding to entrepreneurs, and you've been an investment banker and venture capitalist, which you are now. So you provide a really interesting perspective that others can't have.
Well, you know, that comes with decades of masochistic experiences. What can I say? Maybe that's why I don't have the ability to have vision anymore. I've been pounded down.
I was looking at some of your postings on Forbes.com, and you know, they're interesting papers. Which one is your favorite, and can you give some key points from it?
Oh, my God, Forbes.com is a long time ago. You know, the nature of Forbes.com was Q&A. It was sort of Ask Guy, right? Really, my current work is done on my blog. And in my blog, what I'm trying to do is create the highest signal-to-noise ratio on the Internet. So when I write a blog entry, it takes me 2 or 3 hours. And the purpose, or my sort of mental model, is someone will read a blog entry, print it off, show it to the rest of his or her team about how to run a company or create a brand or schmooze or raise venture capital. I'm trying to have very, very informative blog. Now, other people have blogs that are rants and raves, and other people provide this sort of news bot service where they go all over the Internet looking for interesting things that other people should read. I have no desire to do either of those things. What I want to do is basically provide almost chapters. So when I write a blog entry, it covers the topic from beginning to end. And, you know, that's why I can't post every day. I don't have the energy to write that kind of article every day. I would like to have the most informative blog on the Internet.
Well, you've made the Technorati 100, and you're gearing for the top 10.
Well, that doesn't mean I'm going to make the top 10, but you know, you've got to have goals in life.
So why the blog title change? I mean, doesn't it sound somewhat academic, and maybe people won't understand it?
Which change? I've changed it several times.
Well, that recent change, you know, about signal to noise, but it's like in Latin or something.
Yeah, you know, I changed it for about 24 hours. To signal to noise, but the Latin didn't translate very well, and then, you know, to really translate in Latin well, it takes a bunch of words. It's not as simple as I thought. So I put it back. I now have it. I started it off with let the good times roll, and then I translated that to Latin, and then I went to, you know, all signal, no noise in Latin, and then last night I said, let's just go back to the Latin, let the good times roll. The Latin for let the good times roll is bona tempora volvantur. And I thought maybe I should be funny and I'll make it bona tempura volvantur. And then it will be let the good times, or let the good tempura roll. So I might do that just as a, you know, pun. Well, I'm combining a little bit of Japanese and a little bit of Latin.
So, you know, I have this question. What, in your opinion, makes your blog so successful? And I think you've talked about some of it already, you know, that you're sort of putting out chapters. But can you sort of make it in, you know, three pointers of, I'm a blogger, I want to be successful, I want to be guy like Guy Kawasaki, I want this huge audience coming in and building like crazy. How would I do that?
Boy, I wish I knew the answer to that. All I can tell you is what I'm doing, and what I'm doing is I'm trying to have very, very high content level. You know, not rants, not raves. I'm not a news bot. I'm not looking for I read very, very few blogs. In fact, I can't tell you I read anybody's blog. The only blogs I read is I look at the people who have cited me to see what they're saying about me. But I literally don't read anybody else's blog every day. So what I'm trying to do, again, is make my blog into essentially an online book. And now to do that, you have to have a lot to say, or you have to, you know, have good judgment in who to copy. so it's I don't know if I can recommend this to other people.
Well, you know, it's actually, I've been following your blog, and there's so much useful information in there. So it's a situation where you go in there and you always walk away and say, gee, I've got five key factors I can use in what I'm doing. And you always relate it to different things that a person can do, not just involving startups. So, you know, in fact, at this conference that I was speaking at, I said, you got to see this, you know, Guy Kawasaki's blog. It's got some really good material in there.
Many times I'll be driving along and I'll say, you know, I ought to write a blog about that. And I really, let me find this, you know, a little bit romantic, but I really would love, I love the thought that people are reading my blog and they're getting information that impacts their lives, that they can, you know, actually change something or change their presentation or do branding better or do schmoozing better or do something better. I feel like it's almost a moral obligation I have that if I can get this knowledge and this analysis and put it out, it'll make the world a better place.
Okay, so when I look at your blogs then, are you planning to monetize it in a kind of direct sense, or is it sort of something where, you know, you're giving back and you want to provide information, or it's a combination of the two?
I'm running blog ads, and I have run Google AdSense, but, you know, that it never will amount to more than several hundred dollars a month. And I'll use that several hundred dollars to buy hockey equipment or pay for my league fees, but it's never going to be big money. It furthers the Guy Kawasaki brand. It probably helps me get paid speeches. It is a moral obligation, and it's very fun. I wish I could just sit and blog all day, and it's very rewarding, not necessarily financially, but it's very rewarding to do it.
Are you planning to get into vlogs or podcasts?
No, because I believe that, you know, a podcast or an audio recording should really be done very well. It needs to be, it takes, I think, because I've done some, I think it's about an 8-to-1 ratio. So if you want 1 hour of podcast, it takes 8 hours to get there between editing and redoing and, you know, rehearsing and all that and writing it down, what you're going to say, and scripting it. It really is a lot of work. And so I don't have 8 hours to do it. I'm not going to do it. It's too much. And I don't want to, I don't do audio interviews like this. I don't know. It took me 3 years to get to blogging. Maybe 3 years from now I'll get to podcasting.
Well, you've been doing blogging since what, December, right?
January 1st.
Which recent blog do you think is your favorite? And can you share, you know, maybe a few lessons from that blog?
Well, okay. So yesterday I did one, 10 questions, you know, quote unquote, with Jackie Onassis. And that was based on a book that I read, What Would Jackie Do? And this is a good example of something I would do, which is there are not a lot of bloggers, particularly A-listers, who are reading books about Jacqueline Onassis. You know what I mean? And very few of them would write a blog about this. So this is kind of a aha-ism. This is kind of a wink between myself and my readers that, you know, no one else is going to do something like talk about Jackie Onassis on a blog that's essentially about business. So I like to do things like that, and again, I want stuff that's tactical and practical. I wrote a blog about the art of sucking up, which I think is a very, very important and legitimate skill, and lots of people went crazy. They hated it because, you know, I think they're all hypocrites who hated it because they're saying that, you know, you don't need to suck up to me, and I would never suck up to anybody. Oh, that's crap. So, you know, I like to mix it up a little.
Well, I noticed in your Jackie Onassis blog, you talk about where she sucks up when it's important, and you can get something out of it, right? And there's some value being offered.
Right? Yeah, I think people, they do not like the word sucking up. It is too, probably honest. It's too, I don't know, it's too grotesque a description of what you're doing. But, you know, at the end of the day, if you or I were having, and I were having a casual conversation, we would say, you're sucking up, right? I mean, you know, we would describe the process of sucking up. So, you know, why not call it sucking up? It is. That's what we're doing.
Guy, you've had a long career, and you probably get this question quite a bit, but I'm going to ask it too. And, you know, is there, you know, three or four pointers from your career that you can pass on, sort of like in sort of a mentorship way to the audience that say, you know, I learned these things and they made a real difference, and I think if you did this, it'll make a difference in your life or in your career?
Well, I think if I had to keep one thing in mind, maybe I have two things. One is that, again, you should never ask people to do something that you yourself would not do. And that'll keep you pretty good, keep you on the straight and narrow. And the second thing is that at the end of the day, it's all about family and friends. It's not about money and companies and stuff like that. And, you know, when you get to be 51, you start appreciating things like that.
Well, Guy, you know, any other thoughts in closing?
No, I got to get back to blogging, so.
Right. Well, Guy, thank you for taking the time to
My
do this
pleasure.
Interview. And
glad to help.